Welcome to the Telehealth and Medicine Today Unscripted Journal podcast series, where industry innovators transform healthcare. Today, our guests are Susanna Fox, author of the book Rebel Health, Paul Barrick, Chief Medical Officer, Pegwin, and moderator, Sarah Bell, former VP, Product and Clinical Evaluation at Bioformis. Let's listen in on part two of our Rebel Health discussion on how we can assist patients get their power back.
Hey, everyone. Excited to bring another episode of Rebel Healthcare podcast on Telehealth and Medicine Today. This episode is going to focus on Rebel Healthcare workers. And I have a Rebel himself in Paul here, and Susanna has written the book, Rebel Health, A Field Guide to the Patient-Led Revolution in Medical Care. The book's landed. Paul and I have both read it. It's just fantastic. And so let's do a round of intros quick. Susanna, if you can introduce yourself.
My name is Susanna Fox. I am the author of Rebel Health. I come to this after 20 years of doing research in patient-led communities, as well as national survey research. And I served as the Chief Technology Officer at HHS, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, in the Obama administration.
Great. And Paul?
Hi, Sarah. Dr. Paul Barrish. I'm an anesthesiologist and intensivist. I've been researching healthcare improvement for about 25 years. I'm a cancer survivor, and I work a lot with patients to help transform the healthcare system.
Great. And I'm Sarah Bell. I'm a nurse. I spent the first almost 20 years of my career in nursing at Mayo Clinic in the Midwest. Since in the past year have escaped the confines of, you know, academic medical and gone into startup world in virtual care, and have been enjoying some of the freedom that comes with really designing solutions for patients, for healthcare workers, as we move into this future state of the unknown. But given that, today, what we're going to talk about is really talking about our rebel healthcare workers and looking at anyone working inside healthcare who's really fed up with that status quo, looking for the positive change, improving health outcomes, keeping people safe, finding effective treatments, or bringing better products and services to the market. They need new strategies and allies. And Susanna, your book has just been fantastic. And there's, I think, a real movement happening here of the rebels that are coming out. Since our last episode, the book's come out and has dropped. And just curious, how has the response been? What are you hearing from patients, from healthcare workers as this has landed?
Thank you so much. It's been awesome. I've done about a dozen public events, and it's been a mix of general public bookstore type events, as well as meetings with hospital administrators and healthcare executives across the board. What's interesting to me is that when I go and talk to the general public, people who are patients, survivors, caregivers, or curious or angry about the current system, they're very intrigued by the title Rebel Health. And a lot of them say, we want a real revolution. You're pointing to this treatment and device innovation revolution. We want to turn the whole thing upside down. We want the financial side of healthcare. We want the insurance industry to be revolutionized. And I say, great, that's a different book. My focus has always been on patient-led, caregiver-led, survivor-led innovation in medical care and treatments. When I speak to healthcare executives and doctors and nurses, what I notice is the closer that they work with patients, the more the book resonates with them. If they are further away from actually working every day bedside or with patients, the more they are curious but not yet convinced that there is a patient-led revolution happening. So I'm really excited to bring that news to everyone who doesn't yet know about the revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. And Paul, we had a little bit of conversation before we started about is rebel health enough? Is that a strong enough word? What's kind of your take on this revolution and where it needs to go?
Well, in order for a revolution to succeed, you need four things. First of all, you need a vision. You need a direction. So that's where Rebel helps. What you need next is you need a burning platform to engage people widely. You need to have a change management model in order to go from here to there. And you have to have the political, financial, and social resources to get there. So I think this is a great recipe for where we need to go on how to drive change. That is to say, it captures the zeitgeist of the unhappy points, the burning platform. What's next is really channeling that to a real mechanism of change. And that's hard. And that's something I hope we can talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. It is hard to get from the concept of things need to change to the action of creating change, right? And yeah. One of the things in your book, Susanna, was talking about, you know, this ecosystem and the patient-led revolution. And I'm curious, as the books dropped and, you know, I'm sure you're hearing lots of stories and lots of patient stories and family member stories about how healthcare has failed them, and maybe even specifically with like rare conditions and things that haven't been figured out yet. Can you share some of those stories and where maybe Rebel Health is helping or where there's still opportunity to help this group of patients and families?
Yes. One of my goals in writing the book was to give people language to describe the work that patients and caregivers and survivors do that has before this not really had a name. It's not really, besides terms like e-patient or participatory medicine, there's not been names for the kinds of work that patients bring to healthcare and innovation. And so by naming seekers, networkers, solvers, and champions, people are responding to that and writing to me and coming up to me at events and saying, thank you. I now understand that I am, for example, a solver networker, or I'm a champion, or I really want to be a networker. I'm going to learn how to be one. The other thing, especially with rare disease, is this, what people find when they're at the beginning of a rare disease journey is that they often say that they feel invisible. And that's where the Rebel Health Matrix comes in, where I wanted to have a visualization, frankly, to help healthcare executives, but also patients and survivors and caregivers, to have a picture of where is the suffering happening and where is it unseen. And I'll describe the matrix quickly. The vertical axis at the top, it's visible to mainstream healthcare. And at the bottom of that x-axis is invisible. And then there's that's the y-axis. And then the x-axis, the horizontal axis is on one side, people's needs are not being met by mainstream healthcare. And at the other side, people's needs are being met. And so the quadrant, if you can imagine in your head, down at the bottom where people feel or are invisible and their needs are not being met, that's where a lot of suffering is happening, and that's where a lot of people start their journey in rare disease. One of the challenges is that they don't know how to describe what's going on with their child, for example, because so much of rare disease happens in babies and children. And if you join a peer-to-peer community, you can get language. You can start to describe symptoms in ways that clinicians can hear them. And people can also say, start tracking those symptoms, start taking notes. So the next time you go in, or when you finally get to see that specialist, you're going to have essentially a at-home clinical record of what's going on. And people can gain those skills in peer-led groups that often happen online. And that's where people can step into their power as patients and caregivers.
Yeah, some of it comes down to that validation, right? Often, I as patients come into the healthcare system and there's a rare or unknown condition going on, there's this sense of maybe I'm losing it. Maybe this isn't real. Maybe I'm crazy. And it can be hard to find that confidence to sit with that and keep asking questions and keep seeking answers. And Paul, you're a patient advocate, you're a physician. thoughts from the advocacy point of view and working in that space, and how does that juxtaposition as like a physician, how has that come together for you?
Well, I described on Oprah many years ago how that happened, but very briefly, I was put into a situation as a learner, which I wasn't prepared for. I didn't know how to push back, and I went on and caused harm to a person who went on to pass away, and was then told that I was more trouble and I should just leave. And so that sort of began a long journey about 25 years ago, which is important to acknowledge that many of the telltale problems, we'd love to blame them on Washington, but they actually begin in medical school. They begin at the seed one, day one. So the culture devoted to quality or not is not an external problem. It's an internal problem. We in healthcare, there's more than enough to throw out on Washington politicians, but that's not what I want to focus on at this point. We in healthcare aren't really focused on a culture of quality. When we say a culture of quality, we mean a culture that's carefully designed around the patient and the carers. It's designed around transparency of information. It's designed around shared decision-making, and it's designed around accountability. Those principles are things that we in the healthcare system, physicians, nurses, health managers, allied health, anybody who lives inside the ecosystem, which is a big ecosystem, close to 20% of every US dollar formally is through healthcare, and probably at least 30 to 40% if you include aged care and home care. Probably up to 40, 45%. So it's a huge part of the population, a huge part of the GDP is focused on healthcare. So unless and until we acknowledge and start thinking about a culture that's devoted to quality, again, that has transparency around processes, where there's accountability and responsibility for what gets done to the patient around information and follow through. And unless we use a culture of measurement, because without measurement, there is no quality. Quality is not words. Quality are tools that measure processes. So it could be fever, it could be falls, it could be infections, it could be days out of hospital. In short, a much more quantitative approach, and then making that available to consumers, to patients, to families, so they, underscore they, can make decisions that's right for them with the right tools to transform a qualitative theory into an actionable platform, which is an accountable. That needs to be funded more broadly. But at least from our perspective in the system, we have to acknowledge that if we're going to get to where Susanna as Bowlby tried to take us, we have to change the culture of care.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I'm sorry that you had such an impactful experience kind of at the beginning of your medical career. I think myself being a nurse, definitely in those first early years, were put in positions of, ooh, I don't know if this is right. I don't know that I feel safe to say something. And you're kind of gripping the handrails, trying to like just, you know, get through that moment with that patient and get there. And this is only going to be exacerbated, right? We have massive shortages coming. And with the more the shortage progresses, the more the focus on quality becomes difficult, because we're staffing beds, we're trying to staff the healthcare system and the finances behind that, right? Keep people moving.
Yeah, I mean, nothing about what we're saying is particularly novel or interesting, actually. This was done in industry 75 years ago. So Henry Ford and Deming and others built the principle of how to use quality to drive better performance, to drive better financial performance, but most importantly, quality of service. All that's out there. It has been out there. It's not particularly unique. Healthcare has discovered it about 40 years ago, and we're still in that revolution. But there's a massive gap between some elements that are doing a really, really good job in Kaiser and Henry Ford, other places like that. And there are others that are still struggling to truly embrace a culture devoted to quality. And that means everything. It means how we recruit, how we hire, how we incentivize. That ultimately leads to better financial performance, i.e. more profits, if that's your driver, or more performance and more resources to enlarge in the footprint, and then deal with the equitable aspect, which is offering healthcare insurance to all people, including those who are uninsured, something that all Western democracies do except the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Susanna, any thoughts on that? I think those were some compelling statements by Paul. I mean, he hit the nail on the head, but from your perspective?
I love it. What I would add is that there are lots of what people call consumers, patients, survivors, caregivers, who stand ready to help, who stand ready to be eyes and ears, looking out for their loved ones, for example, making sure that the quality of the care that they or their loved ones are receiving is high. They're also standing by to help, for example, design better clinical trials. If you want to make sure that a hospital is being run well, you should make sure people who are not on the organization chart are also part of the conversation. And that's everyone who works at the hospital and everyone who is at the hospital unpaid. There's so much knowledge in healthcare that is not being tapped because nobody yet is really asking patients, survivors, and caregivers to contribute to these conversations. And that's not just hospital care. That's home management of chronic disease. That's device innovation. All across the board, patients and caregivers are ready to contribute to this conversation in a meaningful way.
And then how do they? I mean, there's a lot of different ways to contribute, but as a healthcare worker, as somebody who is, you know, working the shift work, how can they take part in some of this revolution and kind of start from that bottom up? Any thoughts?
So one way is to create programs where there are people working together. For example, there's a really cool program called Maker Nurse that helps hospitals create maker labs and maker spaces in the hospital. Nurses are constantly innovating, just creating a way out of no way, using whatever they have on hand to, you know, make someone comfortable or to make that work in the moment. And so Maker Nurse saw this and said, why don't we create a place where there are materials maybe an engineer on hand that actually patients and caregivers are welcome into the lab as well. So there's some really great examples where a nurse and a patient work together to design a pillow, for example, where a new mother who had a spinal cord injury was able to hold her baby. Another example is a teenager who had a spinal cord injury was able to help co-design with nurses and engineers a modified keyboard so that she could play her favorite video game while she was in recovery from spinal surgery. These are the sorts of ways, like how might we think creatively, you know, and that's just examples in the hospital. There are also examples of home care where people can tap into, frankly, 40 years of the academic literature that shows that if we're talking about behavior change, we need peer support, whether it's in recovery from substance use disorder, eating disorders, living with serious mental illness. We also see it in diabetes. There's a lot to do with home care and peer support that I think frontline medical workers could tap into.
Any comments on that one, Paul? Any other groups or thoughts on how, as a healthcare worker, not in a leadership role, not within that org chart structure, how can they take part in some of this revolution and making change?
Yeah, I mean, there's many examples, both in the U.S. and around the world, in which patients and patient representation are actively involved in hospital committees. They're actively involved in tag teams that are rethinking different processes that are relevant to the local care providers or patients. And so this is not a top-down process. For it to work, it has to be driven by people who care about it. So if the problem, for example, that patients post cardiac surgery when they're in bed, they can't reach the toilet paper or they can't reach the light switch, clearly it's a design problem, right? So using patients and family members to work with human factors engineers, a relatively new domain in healthcare. It's been around for about 90 years in healthcare, probably the last 15 years. There's probably about 10 hospitals in the U.S. out of 8,000 that have full-time human factor engineers, that their task is to think about the interface between people and technology, either hardware or software, doesn't matter. The point is how to accommodate the technology to the limits of humans. Humans have limits, their constraints. Technologists don't always think about that. They think that the idea, if you can solve the idea, the people will come. The reason why 90% of healthcare startups fail is because they don't understand that fundamental principle of the usability in the real world, constrained by noise, distractions, and dozens of other things going on, as opposed to an isolated device or service that's separate from our life. So that idea of using, in a good way, patients and providers and survivors as a way to rethink cancer treatment, as a way to rethink sepsis treatment, as a way to rethink child pneumonia, on and on and on. The idea of using patients in the best possible way, as Susanna said, they want to be part of this, but they're often not invited. Or if they are invited, it's tokenistic. It's a few hours before a process goes on. It's not throughout the entire DNA of the project. So that really is the message. If we really want to drive towards a culture of patient-centeredness, we have to respect and engage people in a way that they feel listened to and that they can have an impact. Because the worst possible thing is telling patients or consumers, we'd love to have your input. They give their input, nothing really changes. Then they get really angry. And they get angry because you've asked them for their input. They assume that it's not just tokenistic. It's not just something to put on the website, but it's something that will transform your workflow. So engaging patients in all aspects of workflow in a way that respects those principles that Susanna said, that really is the challenge that we've struggled with.
Yeah, I agree with that. And there was another point in your book, Susanna, where you talked about really mainstreamed grassroots groups, you know, specifically like AA and La Leche League and other things as examples that have really come into their own in healthcare. They're groups that people refer to and that they often collaborate with their healthcare team while going to some of these groups. Can you talk about how this has evolved? And maybe even, Paul, would like your thoughts, just being in the advocacy space as well, like what's the future for how some of these groups continue to partner with healthcare systems to provide advocacy?
Thanks for asking about that. That was one of my favorite sections of the book to write because I got to go back into the history of patient-led movements, radical health movements. And I just I started about 100 years ago and came forward right and stopped my timeline at the internet age. Because it's important for people to remember that what we're describing is ancient, that it's always been true that people turn to each other for advice and support and care. In a disaster, the first responders are actually your neighbors and bystanders before the lights and sirens arrive. And that is true when we are thinking about places in the United States where, because of discrimination, people were left out of mainstream healthcare. You know, you think about the Jim Crow South and how people needed to band together to get healthcare into Black communities. Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the stalwart examples of peer-to-peer healthcare. It was started in the 1930s, and it now stands as a model for so much of peer-led substance use disorder recovery. And I also think about, for example, Fountain House, which is a model of peer-led, the clubhouse model for serious mental illness. And because people were, again, invisible to mainstream healthcare and not recognized for having expertise, they banded together to show that they do have expertise in caring for each other. And there's an example throughout all of the 20th century, right up to during the HIV/AIDS crisis, the formation of the group ACT UP showed that through community-led science, they could get the attention of the FDA and NIH and actually get drugs approved based on peer-led scientific testing of treatments. And that's, I think, a really promising future because it is quite settled that behavior change, as I was talking about before, in terms of mental health and diabetes, it's really quite settled science that peer-led groups are useful. What I think the new frontier is and could be expanded into is peer-led community science discovery for treatments and device innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another layer that's evolving is social media influence as well, right? Instagram, TikTok, Facebook groups has really added another layer to peer-to-peer kind of groups and like seeking support online. And I think Gen Alpha, Gen Z, they're probably ahead of the curve in terms of, you know, eventually that's going to be their main source of finding peers who have a like scenario that they do. Any discoveries there, Susanna, as your book has dropped and you've been talking out there?
What I find really cool is that the mode has changed and maybe the glossiness of the tools has changed, but the same instinct that a lot of us had at the beginning of the internet where it was just text-based, it's the same. It's that sense of connection, that feeling of finding someone else who shares your same condition and who shares the same feelings and challenges, and even better, if they're a little bit ahead of you on the path, can say, oh, here's something that I tried that works for me. And you know, understand that misinformation can spread on social media just as it did during the blog era. You know, there are downsides to people connecting peer-to-peer, but the upside, if people are given access to scientific journal articles, if people are given access to the science and they're able to share that along with that practical advice of someone else who's been there, again, whether it's on a blog or an old school email listserv, or it's a super awesome TikTok, highly produced Instagram reel, whatever it is, it's at the base, it's human connection.
So the principles don't change. The mode does, but the principles don't.
Exactly.
Paul, any comments from your perspective?
I think fundamentally, in all systems of life, if you've ever bought a house or had a carpenter help or build something around your workplace, the more you know about the problem, the more you understand about the choices, the more likely you are to get good outcomes. Unfortunately, we've all perhaps had an experience of working with contractors or help that we felt that we got taken advantage of, often because we don't know the difference between what things actually cost. We don't realize that a small difference means a dramatic increase in cost. Often it's described in loose qualitative terms. Would you like this mode or that mode? Not realizing that mode is so much more expensive for very little marginal benefit. The point is that we as citizens, as consumers, understand that to get a good car, you have to learn deeply about how cars work. You have to understand the mechanics. You can always buy a car just off the lot, but if you want to get a really high performance car, you have to spend time to learn about it. We often don't think about that in healthcare that way. If you will, often the assumption is that when you go into healthcare, you'll get great quality care without having to actually participate in the process. So we've talked a lot about how the system needs to change, and I like to think about how the consumer has to change too. And that means consumers have to become more wise about healthcare, about their body, about their diet, about what it means to smoke, what it means to drink excessively, what it means to not exercise, not just in highfalutin terms, but in terms that are meaningful to them. So you know full well that if you continue to act this way, you will get diabetes. This is your responsibility. That's a very different way of thinking about healthcare activation and agency. So it's not just giving patients and consumers more power. It's also a responsibility that they need to learn more about their illness. And by doing so, they'll be asking better questions. By doing so, they'll get better insights from people around them. And I think by working with other people, I've been impressed with patients who have had common illnesses or diseases that they had in common, I should say. And they learn to work together by sharing information, by working as a group, by realizing in a very positive way that it's difficult to customize treatment because there's so many variations. And so the best way to get a great outcome, in addition to having a great team, is to be a very active consumer. That means asking better questions. It means keeping better records. It means reading what you're being given. It means going deeper beyond the superficial so that it's part of you becoming a part of the clinical team, if you will. We call this the microsystem. And often it's a bit like that movie, The Circle of Trust, you know, where patients are seen outside that circle. But I see patients, when I was a patient, I told the team, you're my team. And they said, what do you mean? You're the patient, we're the team. I said, no, you're my team. I will tell you what I need you to do for me. You will tell me if it's wrong and you'll tell me other things if you like. But the concept that I should be able to be actively part of all decision-making is something I think we have to stress and help consumers. So we've developed courses for patients. We develop courses for carers. So if somebody comes to the intensive care unit, we help the family understand what to look for, when to best come, what type of things should they be thinking about? Would they like some light reading, L-I-T-E? Would they like deeper reading? So the idea is we can engage you wherever you are at your socioeconomic or educational level. If you want to go deep, we'll give you that service. If you just want a superficial encounter, that's okay too. But either way, the idea is that we want you to be part of this. And that starts with showing up, but it continues by being actively involved, particularly when we're talking about chronic illnesses. So that means from now until the end of your life, this will be with you. So that means, how do you learn to manage that issue? If it's obesity or diabetes or heart disease or lung disease, and I don't think we've done that enough. We've often treated patients as recipients of care alone and not as participants in the journey of healing. And we know from a lot of evidence that when patients and family members better understand the disease, there's better compliance. They take the medications, they come to the clinic on time, they follow up at home, and they often get better care and they have better outcomes. So it's clear that it requires the active engagement by consumers as individuals and as communities, learning together, working together to share the wisdom so that they can get better outcomes and have better wellness.
Yeah, well, I love ahead, this Susanna. Vision of a team, and I'll add that patients also sometimes, hopefully, come with a team of their own, and that is their family and friends who care about them. Because if a patient is not able because they are exhausted, because for all sorts of reasons they're ill, they can't be the one who is actively engaged. It's important to know that they don't have to become the seeker of information or the networker. There could be somebody who is a friend who could do all that reading for them, or their primary caregiver, whether it's their child or their spouse or their parent. That's a person who can step into their power and be part of the home care team. And if we recognize that everybody potentially has the power to change the outcome for the better, and we give everybody the tools and information they need, then I think that we will be better off. And that's the vision that I hope that we all share. And in some ways, I hear from patients that there is pushback, where a doctor will say, look, I'm the doctor, you're the patient, you know, stop bringing all of these ideas. And there's a sense that it probably was easier to practice medicine before the internet emboldened everyone to get a second opinion from Dr. Google, or to do your own research and bring that in. But we can't put the cat back in the bag. And I invite everyone to embrace this possible future, because I think that it is the road towards a better and more equitable healthcare system if we recognize that everyone has power.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I would agree. The challenge, and it's important that we acknowledge the challenge, because solutions are only good if you can recognize their limitations. And so the challenge is with limited resources and lack of staffing and 8 minutes approximately that HHS prescribes for primary care docs to see a patient, it's difficult to do that. And so we have to think about how do we best design the environment, the data systems, and the workflows that allow that type of time to engage, right, Susanna? So if we tell a primary care doc all the stuff that you said, we agree. Okay, now you have 8 minutes to listen to the patient, diagnose the problem, write a summary in the EMR, which is kludgy and impossible to use properly, and we're going to punish you if it's more than 8 minutes. How do they do that? How? Oh, and do not turn your face to the patient. As you're writing on your EMR, your face to the patient. Otherwise, you can go home and do pajama time 2 hours at home every night because you don't have enough time during those 8 prescribed minutes. So how do we honestly talk about the need for agency for patients and knowledge with the constraints of the system that are squeezing physicians and nurses? How do we do that?
Yeah, we need to be creative because we're at a breaking point. And yeah. I have empathy for the primary care clinicians. But as we talked about at the top, we have a shortage. And so who's going to fill in? If you can't get a primary care clinician to even meet with you, what are you going to do? And one possibility is that you turn to peers, you figure out better what's going on. It's almost like a flip the classroom model where you do all of the reading ahead of time so you can make the most of your 8 minutes. And so I think there's an opportunity also for patients and caregivers to think about how to optimize that meeting time and how to have done all the reading yourself so that you go in with questions. And often when people ask me, so how do I stop this doctor from dismissing my research? The advice that I've read about and therefore I pass on is to say, don't come in with statements, come in with questions. If you ask a very good question, I have never met a doctor who's not intrigued by a very good question that you might ask.
I would agree. And I think there's here, actually, of all things, I think there is a good use for a variety of startup tools that can be adapted to the various levels of understanding and depth of interest. And having that before you come to the physician or nurse, so you're able to ask better questions. And I agree with you, absolutely. I mean, the other thing I think is having realistic expectations. It would be great to not get cancer. But once you have it, how do you learn to deal with it? And that's another challenge altogether, which often leads to unwillingness to accept the consequences, unwillingness to deal with the treatment side effects. And so, you know, being more realistic about that by learning more about what others have been through. So if you do have a disease that emerges, spending the time to talk to other patients who have had this disease, other parents who have a child who has congenital heart disease, et cetera. So, you know, using that time, your own time, if you will, and not using the limited time that the nurse or physician have in order to not abuse that constrained resource, for example.
So this is like a fantastic conversation. And we know as healthcare workers, we want the patient, you know, to have some stake in the game, right? We want them to come prepared to maximize time. I think the last question of this episode is, what specifically is the healthcare professional's role? Where do they fit in this revolution? Just a simple question and thought there. Paul, do you want to start with that?
I think there, in many ways, the role hasn't changed, which is to bring comfort to patients. To deal with their pain, to deal with their suffering, and to help them make better sense, what Carl White calls sense-making of this chaotic event, which is causing them to come to see the healthcare services. So that hasn't really changed. I think that first thing continues. It's like consent. It's a first, and it continues throughout the encounter that you might have with this set of providers. The second thing is being a guide, you know, helping them understand where to look. There is so much out there. So Dr. Google has brought great goodness. It's also brought a lot of badness. And it's important to appreciate the unintended consequences and the well-documented anxiety that happens when people go on the internet because they have symptom X. And the first thing that they take away is that it's a deadly symptom, when in fact it's number 49 out of 50. It is there. Having understanding the context, weighing the balance of issues there, I think is quite important. And being an agent of trust. So, you know, if they trust the physician or nurse or provider to advocate for them and to be truthful about their situation, I think everything else will be so much better, including the patient saying, "I'm scared. And I don't know. And I went online and I found so much. Now I'm even more confused than I was before." And then, of course, following up, you know, that this issue of not isolated one-off, but many of these illnesses, most of them require follow-up. Our fragmented system in most parts of the U.S. means that you often don't see the same provider a second time, or there's so many other people in the system that you barely even know their name. And so we design the system of transactional anonymity. And by doing that, we reduce the accountability. We reduce the engagement. We reduce the trust. And so by creating a common platform for information, for example, if the hospital, the primary care, and the pharmacy have the same information system like they have in Sweden, it's so much easier for the inpatient hospitalist or doctor to communicate with the pharmacist without having to go through four different levers. That would save a ton of money, but most importantly, errors would be reduced, chaos would be driven down, and ultimately it would be better for everybody. It would also mean cutting out at least a third of the middlemen and women. That's just one example of many where our systems in the community are not designed to make it easy for that communication, without obstacles, without handoff problems, without information being degraded. And so we need to build better systems, and they are out there. And there are some examples in the US, there are many examples around the world. They need to be properly incentivized financially, as opposed to other systems right now, which unfortunately are creating perverse incentives for not doing what Susanna has recommended, for not listening to patients, for not doing proper follow-up, and for not actually delivering a trusting, transparent, and truthful interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. Susanna, thoughts on where healthcare professionals fit in?
So I know that healthcare professionals are the audience for this podcast, and so I want to speak directly and say, I, by the way, agree with everything that Paul said. Most of health and well-being, of course, happens outside the clinic, that so many patients live for 364 days on their own. And it's just the one day a year that they get to see, for example, their primary care clinician or a specialist. And so empowering people to step into their own role as an agent of change in their own lives, making sure that they know that they can connect with peer-to-peer communities of other people like them, other people who are on a cancer journey, other people who live with diabetes, other people who have had, for example, a traumatic brain injury. There's so much good that comes when patients and survivors and caregivers can connect with each other to at least be encouraging, if not proactive, as a healthcare professional in guiding people to say, it's okay. I know you're going to go home and Google this. You might also want to, for example, look at these three patient-led groups, which I've looked at and I think are good in whatever specialty or health conditions you are dealing with in your practice. It's very important to acknowledge the reality of people's lives, that so much of it is happening outside the clinic. And it's our opportunity to encourage people to take power into their own hands and to know that they're not alone. There are people who would love to help them if only they knew how to find them.
Yeah, that absolutely. And we are out of time for today. And I just want to say congratulations on the book, Susanna. It's fantastic. Paul, thank you for all of your work in medicine, in this space, in patient advocacy. And I think the big takeaway, at least for me, is perhaps we're not alone. If we can all kind of get together, whether you're a healthcare worker, whether you're a patient, you know, somebody who's going through an illness, that there is the power in coming together, and coming together can create change and can create meaningful change. And so thanks to you both. And everybody, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We appreciate your tuning into THMT's Unscripted podcast series. Want to learn more or have a comment about the program? Have a novel, evidence-based approach or solution to share with our audience? If so, send an email to info@partnersindigitalhealth.com or visit Telehealth and Medicine Today Journal. Thanks for listening to Unscripted from THMT Journal today. See you again next time.